Let's get started. I'd like to welcome everyone to the work session for the City Council meeting of December 2nd, 2025. Our first item is the annual justice report. Jody Adamson's on the hot seat. Come on. Oh, do you want Judge Miller to come first? Okay.
Wendy even told me. Is that better? I am Jody Adamson. I am the, they retitled this, I am the judicial administrator for the court. And here with me today, I thought was going to talk is Judge Miller, but he's not going to. So you just get me. There it goes. So the motto of the Justice Court is to strive to improve the quality of life in our communities. We are the neutral party between both sides to make sure that everything is handled fairly and to handle it effectively. That's our court staff. It's just been the three of us for 8 years now. We all share in the daily work, the mail, the phone calls, the emails, all the court scheduling, all the grind of it, all three of us share in that. And then we each specialize in different areas within the court. So I'll tell you a little bit about each of us. Kathy Ruggiero, she has been with us for 8 years, and she is 25 hours a week. She works Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. And she primarily coordinates with all of the outside agencies. She handles all the interpreters, all the attorneys on the phone, even everything that they electronically file. She handles all those, our counseling agencies, probation agencies. She deals with all of them. And she does most of the paperwork for small claims and kind of tries to specialize that and keep up with all the new policies and changes to each of those things. She also, her big major task this year, she was put in charge of warrant validation. All of our warrants are on the statewide warrant system, and we have to go through every year and validate each warrant, making sure that there's no new scars, tattoos, their weight hasn't changed. And this year she has gone through about 1,200 warrants. So that's a pretty big task, and she's almost done, and she's hoping to get done by the end of the year. She's doing a really great job with that. So that's a big, huge thing with BCI that they enforce us to do each year. Susie Combe Van Komen. Susie's been with us 19 years, and she's a full-time employee. She deals with a lot of the things once the cases are already established. She checks on all the probations and makes sure people don't violate it by getting new charges or things. She interacts with the jails and the prisons to set up video hearings so we can get the cases taken care of. She also handles all of our collections. If people are late, she sends them notices, orders them into court, and if they don't show up, then she issues warrants on them. She is the alternate TAC, which is the Terminal Agency Coordinator for BCI. And with that, she handles all of our suspense files to make sure that fingerprints match up so that all of the criminal charges show up correctly on criminal histories and on the rap sheets. Once the calendars are ready to go to pretrial, she gathers the information and makes sure she gets it to the prosecutor so that they can effectively get the rest of the information they need. And she also deals with our protective orders and makes sure she stays current with that and so that they can get on there and keeps the records packed full of all of the information. Oh, see, I skipped me. That was pretty cool. Okay, so and then there's me. I oversee all of the operations to make sure that it's following both the city as well as the judicial rules and regulations to keep both both bodies happy. I am in court with the judge for all of our court hearings, and I enter all of the in-court minutes. And I also do all of the budgeting for the court and for our department. I prepare all the court calendars, and what that means is we schedule them in our calendaring system, but then we also have an Excel spreadsheet that then when it's time, it goes to a Google spreadsheet, and we have about six different Google spreadsheets depending on what type of hearings they are, so that all the correct parties can get that. So I maintain all of those and get those all ready and make sure that they're entered in so that we use WebEx for virtual hearings, so we make sure it's all coordinated with that as well. I also do all of the monthly reporting and make sure that the state gets all the information that they need for our numbers. And I am the TAC for BCI. I also handle all of our audits. This year, there's been three audits. The first one that just finally got completed was with BCI, and it's their IT security department, security audit. And we just got the compliancy notice for that one. Then the week later, we got notice that there's a second BCI audit for just maintaining the records and make sure there's no misuse. And then also the regular city audit this year. I also sit in court for our small claims cases, and we have a pro tem judge that's been with us for 8 years, and it's Albert Prano. He used to live in the city, but just recently he moved up to Summit County.
Jody, sorry, dumb question. Remind me what BCI is.
It's Bureau of Criminal Investigations. And then we have Judge Miller. And as you can see from this slide, he is very accomplished. He has been with us for 17 years. Prior to that, a few years earlier, when he was an interim judge, about 8 years prior to that for a while. On a routine basis, we get comments about Judge Miller, about what a wonderful judge he is, that he's kind, he's caring. And just one story, I'm sorry, it might choke me up. One of our employees, Wendy, was out shopping for city business, and somebody said, "Oh, you work for North Salt Lake. You have the best judge." Years ago, I was with him in North Salt Lake and in Centerville. He gave me chance after chance and finally just put me in jail. It saved my life. I was a heroin addict, and I've now been clean 10 years because of him. We hear stories like that all the time about him, so we're very lucky to have him as our judge. Okay, so we are a Class 2 court, which is anywhere from 201 to 500 cases, and we are about 300 cases. And that's combined between us and West Bountiful. We handle infractions, misdemeanor Cs and misdemeanor Bs, and also small claims. We don't handle our city ordinances, but we do handle West Bountiful city ordinances. West Bountiful pays for their prosecution and their public defender, and then we split the retained revenue 50-50 with them. These are all the different programs that we currently use. Yes.
It might be obvious, but why don't we handle our own cases? Is that?
That is handled through Sherry's department for the city ordinances.
So it was obvious. Thank
through
you.
Through the court. Yes, the civil for civil. So these are all the court programs that we currently use. We work on a remote desktop, and everything's stored on the state servers. They are slowly transitioning us over to an internet-based, which hopefully will cut that in about half. But it will also allow defendants to have their own access to their cases. They'll be able to upload documents to their cases and interface more electronically with the courts, which will help save a lot of paper trail and let them be accountable for their own cases. So hopefully this, over the next year, will cut in half. We have lots of different hearings. I've listed the majority of our hearings, the basics. There are others as well, but all of our court, or 90% of our court, is handled virtually through WebEx. Today we had court, and this afternoon we were able to handle 100 cases between 12 and 4. So it's very effective to be able to handle it virtually. We can see a lot more people and a lot more effectively. We hold court 2 or 3 times a month. We have a morning case calendar, and then we also have our afternoon calendar. And then we hold our small claims once a month virtually on a Wednesday. Our bench trials are all on Fridays. Most of them are virtually, but we do have some in person. Next Friday, we actually have about a half a day of trials that will be here in person. And we don't do them very often, but jury trials are also on Fridays, and those are in person only. Our North Salt Lake cases are trending about the same each year. The charges themselves, you can have multiple charges on one ticket, so the numbers don't match with the total cases, obviously. So these, and I did these by calendar year rather than fiscal year, and November is where I ended for 25, obviously. So our 25 cases will still go up a little bit. But they're trending about the same as what we expected and what they were. Other than, thankfully, our DUIs are down. Except West Bountiful, they really like to drink and drive this year, because their cases have gone up quite a bit in those. Our criminal cases, it seems that we've had an increase in the actual number of domestic violence cases, but the charges have gone down, which could be, it's more one-on-one domestic violence assault, not involving as many family members, or things like that. But the number of charges have gone down a lot. Same with our theft, which could mean that people either aren't stealing as much, or they're stealing in greater amounts, so they're going to the district courts instead of here.
You just don't want us to get too excited about it.
Yeah. I was going to say, the chief could probably tell you, and a lot of times it, unfortunately, is because they're stealing higher dollar amounts, and so it's going up to the county. West Bountiful is about the same with that. We have seen a decrease in controlled substance cases. I attribute that more to people getting their marijuana cards, not that people aren't actually doing it, they're just doing it legally. And our total cases between North Salt Lake and West Bountiful, they still are trending at about the same levels each city. And then the last one is our total caseload, and these are the actual number of cases, not the charges. Normally, the amount of charges that we dispose are less than the amount that are filed. Obviously, because we don't take care of every case that's filed in a year, we've got warrants, but then we're also able to clear up older cases when we have time to work on collections. This year, on the other hand, it has gone up so far, and we still have another month to go. We've handled or disposed of 300 cases more than we did last year, and I attribute that 100% to all of you for when you approved a second full-time court clerk. It freed up a lot more time for us to be able to work on those cases and clean them up faster. And the court's been running a lot more smoothly this year. So thank you very much for that. Any questions?
I've got 3.
Okay.
I was kind of surprised that we were splitting 50-50 with West Bountiful, and because we're bigger, but and also we were carrying more cases, it looked like.
We keep 100% of ours. We split West Bountiful's 50-50.
All right. That makes sense. Second question. Defense and prosecution. Do we just use Todd's firm, or do we?
No. Our prosecutors, they are full-time prosecutors with the Davis County Attorney's Office.
Okay.
And then they are contracted with us.
And the same with public defendants?
The public defender is Roger Adams. He actually started out here as our interpreter years ago.
So that was my third question. I knew Roger had moved on to bigger and better things, but that, so he's the public, okay.
Yes, so he is, he started out as our interpreter back in the old building, and he said he loved it so much he went to law school. And he happened to get a ticket here at the same time that we were taking applications for a new.
He's really a dirty basketball player, too.
But that's it.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, I just wanted to say thanks. Thanks for what you do, and thanks, Judge Miller. It's really important, and a lot of times, hopefully, we're not really involved in that world and see what all the comings and goings, but thank you.
You're welcome.
For all of your hard work.
Wendy, do you want me to turn this off?
Mayor, do you mind if I make a comment? I just wanted to thank Jody, since she's here, and the judge, Judge Miller. We should have let you talk, but this is a great team, and they've done a really terrific job together as a team, and the two clerks are doing a great job. What's hard to see, and this happens with so many city departments, is that the capability of these people has grown, and so they're doing more and more. They're attacking any backlogs they might have had are taken care of quickly, and it's just a really terrific group. And Jody has done, she's a leader of that group, and she's an excellent manager, and she's really done a great job.
I just wanted to let you know how amazing the ladies are who are the judicial assistants here. When people come to court, usually they are a little bit more toned down than when they meet the police officers, and when they come to the clerk's window, they're often kind of abrasive, and not everybody, obviously, but there's a handful of them that are not fun to deal with. And I have uniformly heard from attorneys who appear in front of me that they are treated with great respect and dignity from the clerks, and they appreciate them and think very highly of them. They're very efficient, but they're also very professional and do a good job. So they're to be commended, and especially Jody. She's an amazing person and wonderful judicial assistant. So thank you. Any questions for me?
I just have a comment, and to echo what's been said, thank you. You represent us well, and that legacy travels even to the grocery store and other places. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge, for all you do. Being the old guy, I'll take you back in time to the old City Hall. And we used this, we had a council chamber like this, much smaller, and it was also our court. And when we built this building, we had to make some decisions. One of them was, do we keep a court or do we farm it out? And we couldn't have the same setup we have here. We had to like bolt down the benches to the floor so they couldn't throw them at the judge and stuff like that. So, but we made a decision to build, when we built the building, to have a separate courtroom, and I think it's been a good decision. It's convenient for our residents, and it's been a good thing for our city. So thank you all. And all right, our next item is an overview of House Bill 48 requiring municipalities to adopt a wildland urban interface code. Ken.
Some of you may have heard about this item in your dealings with the legislature. It's causing most cities in Utah a lot of anxiety. We have a deadline of the end of the year to do a couple of things, and I'll explain what those are. But this bill is complicated, and it's not yet all worked out between the Forest Fire and State Lands Division and the counties of the state. And they just started having some training on it. So I was at a training meeting about 3 weeks ago, And I'll tell you what I know. And I've been talking to our sister cities in the fire district, and we're not behind. It might feel like we're a little bit behind, but we're going to take action by the end of the year on this, and so we'll be in fine shape. And as well as Bountiful City, they have their information put together. The other cities are not as prepared, and there's numbers of cities along the Wasatch Front, as I've reached out to others, that have just been kind of taken by surprise by this bill. So anyway, let me talk to you about parts of the bill. The acronym that everyone's throwing around is WUI, which is kind of weird. It's weird WUI. I don't know. It's Wildland Urban Interface. These are slides I borrowed or stole from the, no, I borrowed them from the Forestry, Fire, and State Lands presentation. So this particular graphic is very similar to our condition in North Salt Lake, where you have an urban area, maybe down in the flat area, and then we have foothills that has also urban development, and then we have wildland areas that are not developed above that. So if you think of that in three dimensions, it's kind of like from left to right, it's lowlands to highlands. And the wildland urban interface, the best way to think about that is these are developed areas that are near other property that's less developed, or it might be grown with trees and shrubs. It might be wildland areas. It may have been disturbed at one point, but it has vegetation that is potentially dangerous in a fire. And so that's not a technical definition, but to help you see in your mind's eye a little bit what that might mean, you can think of places in our foothills where we have homes that back up to draws that are heavily vegetated. They might back up to the Forest Service land, even though their lot, you know, is big. Their house might be down on the street, but their lot might go up into the hillside, and they have forested areas. Those are the areas we're talking about. So this bill was, like I said, it really wasn't on anybody's radar, and I'm not sure how it got kind of, we spent most of the year not knowing about it, and that's partly my responsibility, I think, and I feel like we kind of missed that one, but anyway, it snuck up on the League of Cities and Towns as well, and just really snuck up on everybody. These are the major elements of this bill, and the parts that impact North Salt Lake or cities is really the number one, is a code adoption requirement. And that goes also hand in hand with the adoption of a map. And there are more than one map is mentioned in the statute, and so it immediately gets confusing, but I'll try and sort through that for you so that you know what the city has to do, and then we'll talk a little bit about what our residents are going to go through, because it then moves to the state and it moves to counties. The Davis County will become involved in perhaps assessing fees on behalf of the state, so we'll talk about those things. Fortunately, in the state of Utah, there is a building code chapter, a set of provisions that has already been adopted by the state of Utah that deals with wildland urban interface. That code is formally been prepared by the International Building, I can't remember even what the term is, International Code Council. International Code Council that prepares building codes for communities around North America. So we have a code. We are processing that code through the Planning Commission. It's a land use ordinance, so it will be subject to a public hearing. That's been scheduled for next week at the Planning Commission, and we will be adopting that code in 2 weeks. So on the 16th, we'll have a meeting. We're trying not to have too much on that agenda for you, but that's one that really needs to be adopted. So The other part of the requirement, as I mentioned before, if you think of this code as having a corresponding zoning overlay, which is maybe the best way to think of this, we need to adopt a map. We're required to adopt a map where we think our wildland urban interface properties are located in the city. So the city staff is doing that right now. We have a few versions of a map that we're working with.
Does the state have a map already?
And that's a great question. The state has many maps that try to identify relative risk to structures and homes, but they do not have a wildland urban interface map, nor will they prepare one for us. The next steps of this bill, they will, at the beginning of 2026, the state will be preparing its own map that is not a wildland urban interface map, but is a fire risk map. And they are going to assess properties that they believe are in a risk category for wildland fire. It sounds like the same map, but it's a different map. And statutorily, it has different purposes, and we'll talk more about what the state's map is going to do also. But if you have questions, we should.
Well, what they're going to do is they're going to assess the risk, and they're going to have a number. And then the insurance company will be able to know that you live on parcel X with a number 7 risk factor.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen.
Or they'll actually assess them a fee to cover potential costs of fighting a fire.
Well, and we're seeing rolling across the country in several states where they simply will not insure anymore. Yeah. And so you're just on your own after potentially paying for decades of fire insurance dropped.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what the teeth are in this.
Yeah. Well, and I'll try and tell you. So I've been accused of putting a positive spin on things, you know. And it's true, I'm a positive person. Let me give you my positive opinion about this. I have read the statute, I've read the code that you're going to be asked to adopt, and there are some very responsible, reasonable, and appropriate regulations that we should have adopted already that will apply to development in areas that are at risk of wildfire. I will explain those to you as we bring the code forward. In fact, I can probably do a report between now and the 16th and just send it to you so you'll be prepared for the 16th. But there are lots and lots of regulations in that wildland urban interface code that we are already doing. We have robust water systems and fire storage, for example, and part of the code deals with that. But there are other parts of the code that will help us support homeowners to lower their risk, both real risk and risk on their insurance categorization. So there are some really good positive things about adopting this code.
You're right. And there's this idea that there's going to be a mitigation fund. There'll be a stash of money that will be put aside to address problems when they happen.
But this is currently an unfunded bill, correct?
It is. Yeah. To us, it's unfunded, yes. So state, I guess I'll just say one last thing about that. North Salt Lake has areas that we are very concerned about with respect to wildland fire. None of us want to have a fire that puts neighborhoods at risk, that puts rows of houses at risk, or that potentially could result in a catastrophic event like some of the things we've seen in California. Now, I don't think the conditions are the same. We don't have the wind conditions or the geography or the climate that exists in Southern California. But we do have risk in North Salt Lake, and So I kind of, as I sit in my role, one of my roles as the risk manager for the city, I think we should take the opportunity to do our best work to help the public be safer. And I think the public is generally safe. I see a lot of houses that have clear areas around them, but I think there is a lot of room for us to make the city safer. And so that's how I've approached this, and maybe that's a positive spin. I do think the insurance question, which everyone is worried about and we ought to be worried about, is a potentially a really negative thing for the state of Utah. So I had a chance. I was in a year ago, I was in a conference with the Utah Insurance Commissioner. And thinking back on that meeting, we didn't have HB 48. This was, predates that. That insurance commissioner raised a red flag and said, Utah is poised to have a tougher insurance experience for our residents because we haven't done as much as we could have done or should have done. So even at the state level, they've been stewing and working on this for a while and knowing it's coming. Well, let me tell you a little bit more about this. So to be clear, on the 16th, you're going to have an ordinance that adopts the building code for wildland urban interface, and you will adopt a map where we will say those regulations apply to these properties on the map.
So it will be retroactive? It won't be for future build only, but it will be implemented retroactively to current houses?
It would be, yes, and it will apply to anyone who does an expansion or an alteration to their property, to their home.
But not existing, it devoid won't be, of any if, changes?
If you have an existing house and you never make changes to it, you will not necessarily have to be subject to this code. You may want to make changes to your property if you're in the risk assessment program to make your risk assessment lower, but the Wildland Urban Interface Code will not impact you unless you make alterations or modifications or expansion to your home or you build a new house. Okay, I talked a little bit about this. On the left is really the city's responsibilities and the county's. On the right is this program that I mentioned in 2026, after the first of the year, forestry, fire, and state lands will be creating a high-risk WUI boundary map. It's a little confusing because then there's two maps out there. And then they have proposed that all structures within that boundary will be assessed a fee. And property insurance carriers are going to be required to use the map to determine fire risk to their structures.
Let me come back to the map. You just mentioned two maps, so we'd have a map and FFSL would have a map. Why not just use FFSL's map? Easy for me to say, I'm really pronouncing that well.
Because they're not the same. So our map is a more general map of identifying locations within the city where we have wildland urban interface between development and undeveloped areas that are at risk of fire. The state's map goes to a deeper level and even gets more specific because they're going to start to deal with individual property owners. And so it's a nuance, and I agree that it could have been the same map, but...
No, that helps. Thank you.
But there is a difference. So this slide just says, you know, that right out of the statute, the division has to set a fee. Here's what they told us in the webinar, that the fee will be variable. They know less about this than what it looks like on the slide, because when you ask them, they really don't know. They really can't tell you what the fee is going to look like. It appears that this would be a one-time a year fee, so it's not a burdensome fee necessarily. But it will change. And the real exposure, negative exposure to property owners is the insurance impact of this, for sure. Insurability, even. We don't really know. This is an interesting part of the statute that counties will be required to enter into an agreement with the state of Utah to collect the fee. And so that's a real interesting part. And in the webinar I was in, the cities weren't really asking a lot of questions, but there were county staff kind of pushing back on this idea of the state really pushing down on counties and saying, you're going to have to do this. Anyway, nobody really knows. But so getting to the impacts on homeowners, the state will determine the high-risk areas. And this is a monumental task, but the state will be hiring hundreds or maybe thousands of inspectors to do individual lot inspections. They will be trained similar to a building inspector, and they will do a formal inspection every 5 years for every property within the high-risk WUI area.
And just clarify, where do those costs to pay for that come from? Do they come from us? Do they come from landowners?
No, they come from the landowner's assessed fee. And so that's where the revenue will come from to pay for it. $100. Okay. And so here's the requirement. Again, I said that before. If you can see, and maybe this is easier to see on your monitors, or maybe, I don't know, if we turn this light off, maybe they can see it.
It's readable
on
my screen.
This is just one draft. This is not the final draft. This is one draft that that we've looked at. And Sherry has actually prepared three different drafts. I didn't think it was super important to go through the graphs and have you guys try to pick different properties or whatever tonight. But and in fact, there, as Todd and I were talking earlier, there is no penalty for not adopting the map in the time frame that the statute says. So I do think we should not have a hang up next meeting adopting the building code. But if you would like to take more time, I'm just kind of planting this seed. If at that time you think the map needs more scrutiny, I will not be asking you to rush the adoption of the map. This map is a really important piece. Everyone within the area is going to be notified that we're doing this. It's going to cause a stir, no small stir, among residents. They're going to have lots of questions. This will be a big deal. And if we want to take more than the next 2 weeks to figure this map out, we should do that. So,
and can I just request, as you're doing preliminary work on this, I really feel like our ownness is to our residents, not to the state. The pessimistic view of this would be that insurance-funded lobbyists proposed this bill to push the burden of municipalities doing the work of assessing every property so that then they do not have to come out here because they're nationwide companies, and that they couldn't do that over the whole country. So they're pushing it to cities to self-identify where they can raise rates and where they can drop. And so I would like to suggest that this is potentially devastating for a lot of residents, especially if they get dropped, as they probably will. So our onus is to, right now, everyone's invisible. Insurance companies, they're blind. They don't know who lives where, because Eaglewood means nothing to them. Once we identify, we're forever identified. And so we are basically outing our own residents to the insurance companies. So that would be my slant on it, obviously biased, because I'm living in that area, but it's potentially very, very negative to the residents.
But I do think the question for us is really this. once you adopt the code, and you all have a chance to read the code and understand what it means to a homeowner to be subject to those provisions, I think that will help us to identify which properties should it really apply to. And as I've had a chance to really work on this, we ought to be really cautious and careful about who we put in and who we don't put in. And I don't think we can do that in the next 2 weeks. Bountiful put their map together with a consultant, and it took over a year to do. And it wasn't related to HB 48. They did a risk study on their own. So they were just ahead of us. And so they're prepared to adopt a map. And it's significantly a smaller area than what we're showing here. So I agree with you that we should be careful. The thing that's difficult, the position that's difficult for us to be in, is that once we adopt the code and the map, we're really out of it. We're not connected to insurability. We're not connected to any of those other issues. And my opinion is that the state of Utah is going to put any property they think that is at risk on their map. So if we leave a property off the map, I don't think that means we've spared them from scrutiny by the state of Utah with respect to your question about insurance and who gets penalized or who gets dropped. Or.
But there's no penalty for discrepancy in the maps,
there's
correct?
No.
So then the onus is on the state to eventually
yes.
have to do the work to add in.
I asked directly that question.
Restate the question? Restate it.
So I asked this question of the staff at the state. Are you going to take our map and make it the high-risk map? And the answer was no. So there's a whole different process that they're going to use. It's a technical, scientific process. They have years and years and reams of data that they put on maps. And they're going to do their process no matter what we do. Even if we didn't adopt this map, if we said, you know what, we're just not going to do it, the state's going to do it.
So say again, then, the purpose of this map would be then what?
The purpose of our map
yeah.
is to identify properties that if they make modifications or expansions, or if property is developed, it should be subject to additional restrictions surrounding fire mitigation.
In construction.
So this map is basically applying the code.
This is applying the code. This is a building code question for our city. And the proposed building code has a very detailed table about conditions. And it even has a formula that we can adopt and fill out for every modification to a home or every new home that will help us to evaluate the relative risk. So my comments at the beginning about being positive about this is that these are precautions we probably should take, because some of our buildings in the foothills and near areas that are wooded are at risk. And so if you just look at it in that way,
safety,
one of our core purposes is really there's room to do better on fire safety for us.
So we're asking questions. We're trying to understand. This is obvious, but this absolutely feels like the kind of thing that we need really good, clear, timely communication to our residents that is proactive
yes.
and not, you know, ahead of
yeah.
when that information hits them.
Yeah, particularly since we have a requirement to notify individual property owners before we adopt them, as a part of adopting the map.
So Ken, would you say, as I'm looking at a broad definition of urban interface, would you say the Foxborough Wetlands is is an urban interface with WILD?
That's a really great question, and you get different answers depending on what you look at. The fire district personnel really would make a strong argument that areas west are also in the wildland urban interface in a category for that. So that's something that we haven't studied as much as we have studied the foothills, but we're also adjacent to a large area on the other side of Legacy Highway. So I'm not a fire expert, but the fire district believes there's a risk, even across Legacy Highway, there's a risk. Because what they observed and what they've told me, what Chief Stewart said to me was that in a unique wildfire situation, it's really wind and embers that create the disaster. And so embers can travel up to a half a mile, and that's how you get risk from the west side of Legacy Highway into the Foxborough neighborhood. If you have conditions like that, if you had a wildfire out in the preserve and you had a wind condition that was just right, embers could cross the freeway and put our structures at risk. So that's kind of as clear as I can say.
Am I correct, though, in understanding that if your property is assessed at a certain level of risk, you will pay more fees into the mitigation fund?
That's correct.
Right. So it's tied to what the risk is. So it's not a flat fee. It's really an analysis of how dangerous the circumstance is. And really what it is meant to do is to avoid a fire like Palisades, right? Taking out entire cities. But on the other hand, if they've done it with a little bit more detail, really what it's to do is for those homes that are in forested areas. That's what we're looking at, really. When you say wild land interface, it's the forested area where we run up against national forest parks, national forest land and so forth.
That's correct. And I would describe those areas as the highest risk areas. Right. So we do have some risk down in the Foxborough area, but it's probably a very low risk category. Not no risk, but very low, comparatively to areas in the foothills. There's lots of things the city can do and should do in the future. These are long-term things, but we could also have programs with the fire department to clear out underbrush, to trim trees, keep growth low in the draws that go up the canyons. We have several little canyons in the city. There's more we can do to mitigate those risks of at least an area where it might start a fire. So
one other thing looking ahead is if we're going to look at different versions of the map for us, that, again, this may be obvious, but to have the rationale or the methodology laid out. And it's okay, I think, if there's some core criteria and there's a little bit of professional judgment. I don't have an issue with that, but just, providing some of that rationale or formula down on paper.
I'm just gonna say right now, we won't be ready to give you that type of map in two weeks.
Okay.
So I think we should just be prepared to adopt the code, and then we will take the time we need to put the map together, as you described, with professional definitions and a methodology that's understandable and something we can explain to the public.
I wouldn't be surprised if the legislature passes a bill to extend the deadline. I just think that it's too short. And so we're running up against it, but I think all the cities are upset about this and want to make sure it's done correctly.
Yes.
And that goes to my question. What are the penalties if we don't adopt the code by the end of the year?
There are no penalties in the bill.
Okay. Because I did go to this meeting in the in St. George, and it felt like it's very preliminary, this bill, and that a lot of changes are probably going to happen in this next session, and we'll understand a lot better what our options are.
It feels a little bit like it's not quite figured out yet. Mm-hmm. The pieces that I think have been around a long time, that building code that we are reviewing right now, that's going to come to you on the 16th, it was drafted in 2006. So it's been out there. We've not adopted it. We could have adopted it at any time. The state has recommended that we adopt it. And if you just think of that just by itself, I think that's a good thing for North Salt Lake to do. But of course, it's your decision to do that. It's not mine, but we'll present to you as all the facts that we can, and you'll have a good understanding of the code.
Can I make a couple comments?
Yeah, please.
So I've been studying it too. And so just so you know, before this bill, counties were already required to adopt the WUI code. So that's been a long time. I adopted it in some of the counties that I worked for previously. And
do you mean
the small
for
states.
Unincorporated?
For unincorporated. And I've also adopted it in like Oakley and Camas when I worked for them, because they were obviously in the Uinta Mountains. But essentially what this code does is it classifies, you have to fill out this fire hazard for every single time somebody does if they change their roof, they're re-roofing, or they do an addition to their structure. And it gives you a rating based on the subdivision design. Does it have two roads in and out? Does it have a water system? What kind of vegetation do you have around your house? Do you have a lawn, or do you have trees that come right up to the structure? What kind of topography are you? What is the slope of the hill that you're above or just below, right? That type of stuff. Then based on that score, you're either a class one, class two, or class three structure, structure that has different standards. So it can be, you have to close the eaves. The eaves can't have vents in them that embers can get up in and start a attic fire. You can't have a covered deck that goes out over a slope that's downsloping without putting protection on the underside of that deck, so that if a fire came up the draw, it doesn't start your house on fire. If you have vegetation that's too close to the house, that'll be part of it, is that you can clear that space. And then the other part on the high risk assessment map. So the way I understood is everybody's going to be a class one when that map comes out, and they're going to give us that in January. And then you have 2 years to, as a homeowner, to try to either harden your house or create defensible space. And then you can have your property reassessed, and you can lower your risk from one to two to three based on what you do to your home. So you could re-roof it if you have a shaker roof. You can fix your soffit ends and your vents. You can clear the trees out around your house for 30 to 50 feet, you know, those things. And then you can have an inspector come in and reassess it. And then you'll be assessed when the fees actually start being collected at the lower rate if you address those issues with the reasons that your property was assessed as a high risk. So that's kind of that part of that. And then the WUI part is just, what do we do? How do we treat construction in these areas that are close to the high, or you know, that include the high risk area, but still are, maybe they're moderate or they're lower risk, but they still are a risk because they're near a draw, or they're near a hillside that has, you know, wild grasses on it and stuff that could, a grass fire could come up. So that's basically what the WUI is for us, is that it's just a construction code that says you build with 3/4 inch plywood or 1 inch firewall on this wall, and all that tech stuff that our wonderful building official will be enforcing.
Well, and I understand that for a future build, how beneficial that would be. But the bottom line is we're mostly built out, other than the cove, really. And so, for example, if I were given the class one highest assessed until I re-roofed, took all of the trees away from my house, we're talking well over $100,000 of fix that the city would be asking to drop my assessment fee and my perhaps being dropped from fire insurance, which is very punitive and unrealistic for most people. So that's why I would ask that we be very protective of our citizens in this, because there's not any upside for current residents to be put in this classification. It won't make us safer as is, because most people just can't afford to do that, so they just take the high risk classification and are assessed the fees.
But can I just clarify, because what I was starting to understand is that the map that the city adopts doesn't have anything to do necessarily with insurance insurability. But are
you
saying
that's the whole purpose of this bill?
Well, I understand.
So once we're outed.
Just to clarify, I'm just trying to understand where you're headed on this. So is your notion, which, as I'm saying it, I think it can absolutely happen. But is your notion, hey, if the city adopts a map and the map's purpose is better safety, well, an insurance company might latch on to that, and then that triggers implications for the homeowner. Is that what you're
getting at? Yes, because our map won't improve the safety of existing homes. It will assess the risk of the home, but it won't inherently improve the safety, because unless everyone puts a good few $100,000 into clearing their trees, proofing the bottom of their deck, re-roofing, our risk is still the same. Our safety is still the same. What it does is it puts classifications and takes the work and the onus from the insurance company, and basically we just self-identify all of the homes that can be assessed a higher fee. But it won't actually change the actual physical safety of our city, because nothing's actually done unless the homeowners decide to do that. The only thing that's done is labeled the risk assessment and any future build or any future, you know, modifications. But that's small.
A lot of our homes up in that neighborhood are newer homes. That is, they're less than 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, because we haven't done a study. It may be that many of those homes are hardened homes that builders at the time knew they were building in the foothills, and were cautious about things like vents to the attic and hardened materials on the outside that would take an hour or more to burn. You know, it may be that we have that situation. So I don't think we should assume that everyone in our map is going to be assessed at the highest risk category, or they're going to lose their insurance or whatever. I think insurance rates are going to go up for people for sure.
I think this is my last question. Yeah. The state's map, which has a different purpose, as you stated, do we know the timing on that?
It's supposed to be early 2026. That's what they've said. I think it's a great point that Councilmember Baskin made, that maybe the legislature will make some changes early in the session. It's possible.
Can I make a suggestion?
I'm so sorry, because I literally just said I'm done. But I want to do an aside to Suzanne, and I'm like, we don't do asides. So I figured I'd just state it. But it feels to me like it's prudent for us to wait and see what the state does. And then we can it gives us more information to decide what we might want to do, you know?
Totally agree.
And the part that I wanted to add, which I think fits with what has been said, is it seems to me that I would like to see a WUI map for our city that is as small as possible and is actually separated from a fire safety map that could apply to the entire city. So if we want the entire city to look like a hardened home, we could say, everybody in the city, we want you to look like this. And if you live right here, your maybe risk or the effort you need to put into doing that looks different than somebody who lives in a different area, but we don't need to classify the areas. Yeah. We've got this map that's required from the legislature, and then we have fire safety code that is separate instead of marrying them together.
Yeah, I understand that. I think that's great direction for us. I will say, I was encouraged when I read the building code. As I read some of the infrastructure discussion in the code, I realized that North Salt Lake is very well prepared, because we have streets that are the right width, we have a robust water system, we have water storage at the highest elevations, and we meet that code. So homeowners in our city are not going to have to deal with things bigger than their home to comply. So that is good news for us that we're starting out in a good position.
And I'm so sorry, I know we're over, but Sherry, quick question. Would it be too burdensome to just create hardened code for our city? Like, so even if they're not in the WUI area, to Elise's point, is it too burdensome to renovations and any new builds anywhere to just have in our city code standard the deck protector, the, you know, and so then to Elise's point, that's just in our code, so we will continue with improvement, being prepared, but without classification.
So all of those standards would be part of the building code, and that's not something that the city can amend very easily without the legislature's help. Like, we used to have a code that said any house that was greater than, I think it was 6,500 square feet, you had to have fire sprinklers. Right. And we had to go through a certain process to get that put into state code just for our city. And then Park City had that in theirs. And there were a couple other cities, or maybe six or seven of them across the state. And then the Home Builders Association or some other property rights coalition went to the legislature and said, hey, this isn't fair. Everybody should just be, if it's over 10,000 square feet. And so then the legislature made us, they recalled all of those. And so now everybody, if you're over 10,000 square feet, that's the only time you can require fire sprinkling. So it would be very difficult for us to do it citywide. If you wanted to do it citywide, then the whole map would, you could just make a WUI map for the whole city. And then everybody's treated exactly the same under the WUI code, which I'm not sure I would recommend that, because certainly some of the houses down in the mid part of town that are not in a high, in even the low risk area, they would be subject to those upgrades whenever they re-roofed or whenever they, and those are older homes that probably were built at lower construction codes than what we have today. The newer homes that are up on the hill, like Ken said, is that they've been built with up to code standards on other things, and some of these things are the same. You know, firewalls are the same. You know, most people don't build with shake roofs anymore. You know, but some older homes might still have some. I hope we don't have very many of those in the city.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Ken. Let's adjourn. Take a quick break, and we'll reconvene in a few minutes.